Session on today's parenting, parenting today, discipline, choice, or chance. That's a good question, because I think most often we tend to discipline, not if we even think of the word discipline, we tend to respond, we tend to punish, we tend to react, almost automatically, probably more the way by which we have been parented ourselves, than by thinking through what's the situation that's really going on right now. So we want to look at a couple of things about discipline and to look at some options, because I think we need, because we each have different children who will get involved with different things at different times when we're in different moods and in different places, that what you may accept in one place you certainly may not accept in the other. What you allow to happen out in the backyard you probably wouldn't allow to happen in church on Sunday morning or any other time or in the middle of the dining hall. So we want to look at what are some possibilities as we look at the activities of our children and how we can teach them what we want them to learn. But we also want to look at some things, and I like cartoons, and you know, where do children learn what they end up doing? I mean, certainly they help their own creativity and imagination, but I like this one that has a dad and son. Dad's got a sweatshirt on saying role model, and the son has a sweatshirt on that says chip off the old block. Or here's Dennis the Menace. And he's saying, walking with Ruff, and he's saying, Mr. Wilson tells me what not to do. Mom tells me what not to do. Dad tells me what not to do. Margaret tells me what not to do. Even my conscience tells me what not to do. There's so many people telling me what not to do that I don't have time to do what I want to do. And whether that's one of the reasons why kids end up doing what they do. Or, you know, what's typical behavior? Here's the cartoon on the fast track, and Mom is on the telephone saying, yes, Mother, but Tina's behavior is typical for a toddler. And she's at the cookies. And the young mother goes on and says to her mother, she tries to get what she wants by screaming and pointing at, yeah, says the kids. So here's Dad with the TV remote control saying, like chip off the old block. And here's for Better for Worse. I don't know, how many of you get for Better for Worse in your papers? She's a Canadian. I could teach courses just on her cartoons. She is so good. Here's Mom telling Elizabeth when Elizabeth was younger. Elizabeth, I asked you to pick up the toys on the front lawn. Elizabeth says, I forgot. Look at this mess. Your attitude is, if you wait long enough, someone else will do it for you. Mom leaves. Elizabeth and her little friend looks at all the mess, and Elizabeth says, I guess I didn't wait long enough. She's going to have to do it now. One of the things that was one of my favorites for most classes, and it pulls a couple things together. When we're working with our children and trying to teach them some basic, what's the rules of society, what is going to be helpful, what do we expect, what are some of our limits, we sometimes get caught up in some kinds of strange, crazy rules, and we also sometimes get caught up in, do we really hear what the other person meant us to hear? Or do we really say and mean what the other person hears us to say and mean? So there's some misunderstanding sometimes in our communication. And here's one of the born loser. The pompous boss is saying, join me for a bit of one-on-one basketball at my club. And the loser says, you're on. The boss starts leaving and says, oh, see you at noon. And oh, don't forget, wear rubber sole sneakers only. It's the rule. So the born loser heads off for his game of basketball and says, weird rule. What did the boss tell him?
Only for sneakers.
Rubber sole sneakers only. It's the rule. So what do we hear and how do we understand? And I think we need to think about the born loser in this cartoon sometimes. When you say something to your children, and you think they ought to know what you mean. And now it may not lead to something quite as humorous as this and as outrageous as this, but also we begin to think, what are some of the weird rules that we have? Part of my philosophy is If you have children who are school age, then I think parent and child need to sit, parent and children, parents, if there are parents, it's two in the household, and children need to sit down and figure out what are the household rules that we need to know. What do I expect of you and what can you expect of me? So what do we really know? What are some of the expectations within the house? That the door gets closed so the flies don't come in, or the coal doesn't go out and the coal comes in. That the lights get turned off. Or, you know, what are some of those basic rules that you would set in your house? And how do you come about understanding those rules? And maybe even the next step would be, is there a consequence should those rules not be followed? So that they know what to expect, and you know what to expect, and you can communicate to each other. And I suggest that if once your kid starts kindergarten, even when they're four, that might be an age to start saying, what, to even talk with them about it. What are our household rules about having friends into play? What are our household rules about eating around the dinner table? But when friends come to visit, either our friends or your friends, or what at bedtime, or taking care of yourself, or taking care of your clothes and your toys, or whatever it is, how can we get done what needs to be done? Some of you have seen in these last couple of days the videotape Winning at Parenting by Barbara Coloroso. That I think is really very helpful, and it's a two-hour tape, 120-minute tape that goes over a whole variety of things, from the con games that kids play on us, to chores, and discipline, and allowance, and meal time, and solving problems, bedtime fighting, rebellion, etc. And if we can come, I use Barbara's tapes a lot when I work as a family life educator for the schools in the area where I live and for KW Counseling Services in Kitchener, Ontario, because I like her philosophy and I can agree with the kinds of things that she talks about. It's one of the best tapes that I've ever seen for being consistent and setting a good foundation for caring and support and helping children to learn. And Barbara talks about that she has a couple of basic philosophies. And one is that she won't treat children in any way that she herself would not want to be treated. And I would add another one to hers, and I talk about what is it that we really want to teach our children for whatever that situation is? What are some of those things we want to teach our children? And then the next question is, how can we best go about teaching what we've decided we want them to learn? Now, we can go through an exercise and just talk. Let's spend a minute now and talk about throw out your ideas. What are some of those important things that you would like your children to learn?
Not to harm other people.
To be caring and kind to other people, not to harm them, okay?
Honesty.
Well.
To be respectful of everyone's opinion.
Be respectful of opinions as well as even respectful of their own feelings, opinions, and ideas. Okay, what else?
How to be good parents.
We want to teach our children how to be good parents. So
by modeling.
By modeling, okay, that's that chip off the old block. Because what they experience from our working with them is what's going to come natural to them when they come into the parenting role. Because we tend to parent the way we were parented unless we make a conscious decision to change.
The importance of listening to each other and communication.
That communication is important, and one important part of communication is being able to listen and hear.
And that's how we solve a lot of our problems. Mm-hmm.
And check out what we're hearing. That's certainly one of the important skills. Anything else?
Good ethics about the materials that they have to use.
Okay, but there's a kind of value system. There's some things that are important that you wouldn't want to, that you feel are so strong and you feel so strongly about that you want to pass them on. And to recognize that kids most often get an idea about what are important values or ethics to the parents by seeing what the parents, how they operate. If they want to emphasize honesty, then how honest do parents operate? Or is it not as I do, but as I say? So we can look at that. Yes.
Healthy self-esteem, self-confidence.
Yes, to feel that they're okay and others can be okay too. It's not one that has to be up and the other has to be down in order for things to work. Okay, I'm glad to hear that not one of you listed obedience. Because there may be some good news and some not so good news about obedience. If we just want them to obey because I said to obey and that you ought to obey adults, then what about some of those adults who may not be as caring about your child as you would like others to be and who may want to use them for whatever reason? And that we want them to be able to begin to think. And that's certainly one of the very bottom foundations of Barbara Colarosa's tape on winning at parenting. How do we teach our children how to think? So we might talk about what's going to be helpful, what might not be helpful. If we did this, what would happen? If we did this, what would happen? So we begin to teach them to be able to think through things and to figure some things out, to use that head for more than carrying around a lovely head of hair and various kinds of hats that kids will wear. So we can have a variety of goals for our children, and then how do we go about teaching them what we want them to learn? And in a sense, that's what discipline is. Discipline is distinguished from punishment. Discipline comes from the Latin word disciple, which means to be a learner. And so we look at discipline as giving life to learning. How do we help them to learn? All those things that need to be learned in order to deal positively, respectfully, caringly with our world and the people around us. So, if you were to distinguish between discipline on the one hand and punishment on the other hand, can you make a distinction between the two? Okay. Which do we put up? Discipline, punishment. Discipline is. Punishment is. What's the difference?
I think discipline is experiencing the natural, logical consequences for your action. Whereas punishment, we have come to the, as a society, we think that they have to hurt, they have to suffer before they're going to learn anything.
Okay. And how many of you were spanked when you were a child?
Okay.
A couple people who were not. Any of you, do you remember more of the spanking or what the spanking was about?
Spanking.
Probably remember more often what it felt like and what you felt like and what went on in your head more so than what it was all about. And I would venture to say that most of us who experienced spanking may have said at some time to ourselves, if I ever have children, or when I have children, if it was a choice or not, I will never spank. And I know that I said that to myself because I grew up in a family with two older brothers and an older sister. And my brothers particularly were quite harshly dealt with by my father. In a sense, I probably wasn't, not because I was such a goody-goody two-shoes, but because the sister that was older did not have good health. And so they started to deal with her differently, and I reaped the benefits of their dealing with her and not the practice of being with my brothers. But I know I was very much a tomboy and very much was around with my two brothers, and I know that when I saw them being whipped with, we lived on a farm with lots of horse straps and such around, and I would see my brothers being whipped with that, I would think, I will never, ever, ever do this with my children. Well, I did get a background in child and family studies before I was married and before I ever had any children, so that I began to know some of the options. It doesn't mean that I probably never spanked, but I'm sure that if we were to have counted, my husband and I could probably count on the fingers of our hands without taking off our shoes and counting with our toes. The number of times we ever spanked our children, and if we looked really closely at that, it was probably not because they deserved it, but because I was probably out of control, which is probably the worst time to ever deal with your children in punishment. But in helping them to experience the logical and natural consequences of their actions at a time when it's neither life-threatening nor morally threatening, so that they can become responsible and recognize that there's a cause and effect.
I think that hurt and suffer are sometimes the result of experiencing natural logical consequences as well, but it's not an imposed, like punishment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is that the point?
Yeah, it's not done because they did something else, that we're going to get back at them, that we're going to see that they pay for it. And that's a very negative, way of approaching teaching them something. So we want to, what is it Barbara Colarosa says, that discipline shows children what they have done wrong, gives them ownership of a problem, gives them ways to solve the problems they have created, and it leaves their dignity intact. Mm-hmm. Four basic parts of discipline. Colarosa would define punishment as being adult-oriented. I do it to you. Requires judgment. This is bad. You are bad. Imposes power from without. Arouses anger and resentment. Probably both the parent as well as the child. Parent has been aroused to anger and resentment and therefore comes down hard on the child. And most often invites more conflict. So if we want to look at discipline as giving life to learning, how are we going to teach? We will find ways that can keep that self-esteem intact, keep their dignity intact, let them figure out what's going on and what can we do instead next time so it doesn't happen. If you do the quick kind of paddle, it erases the board completely and they can go back to doing it again. Did anyone last, I think it was the end of October of this past year, 92, anyone see the ABC TV program on 2020 on spanking?
Yes.
I happened to miss it the first run through, and I was teaching, that was on Friday nights, and I was teaching a class on Monday nights, and I came in to set up, and several women came in early and said, "Did you see?" And I said, "No." And they sat there for 15 minutes telling me about this TV program with tears coming down their face. I've since gotten probably, I've seen a copy of it, and have, we've talked with a number of people about it. As we looked, they followed three families, I think it was, for a period of days with camera crews, asking their permission to film what was going on in the family. Most of them had preschoolers. Then did the clippings of times when they punished their children with spanking. Then they talked with a couple of child developmentalists in a little panel with all the parents together, looking at the video and talking about what were the alternatives that they could use. One was a single parent mother with a child, and there was another mother and father with one or two children, and then a mother and father with four children. Four-year-old twins, a two-year-old, and a baby, I believe it was. And you could see the father paddling the two-year-old because she wet her training pants. Really paddling her. And John Stossel, who was the interviewer, said, "But, you know, don't training pants mean that they'll have some accidents? Could there be an accident?" And father said, "I know that that was not an accident. She did it intentionally." And you see the mother calling one child over and slapping her because she picked her nose, the two-year-old, for picking her nose. That's nasty, 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 nasty. And your hand hurt just from watching. And another time she called, child was sitting on the other end of the sofa, and she pulled her by the braid, long braid, the four-year-old, and said, "Listen to me!" And then she did something to the other twin because the twin had hit her sister, so she called the twin over and she paddled. She said, "That'll teach you for not hitting, or that's for hitting your sister." Well, you know, what is it that we want to teach, and how do we go about teaching it? Do we want to teach children to hurt each other, that when you're angry, hit? When you've lost control, be mean to someone else, whether it's in words or action. Do we want to teach them that sometimes we can get very angry, and we may have some very just or maybe not so just reasons, but either way, we can get very angry, but we still have choices as to how we act on that anger. I doubt there's ever a parent that has ever that has never been angry at a child. I mean, but so anger as a feeling is not right or wrong, it's okay. But we do have choices as to how we act in that anger. And anyone who cares for children, whether it's in Narnia, or whether it's in a preschool, or whether it's in a school classroom, they're not, in most states, at least in Ontario where we live, are not allowed to use physical punishment on a child. And you would think it's difficult to have a couple of preschoolers or even a school-age children in your house, and you have to, you know, you have to set them right by paddling. How would you like to be a teacher and have 25 or 30 of these? And you're not allowed to spank them. Well, teachers find other ways to teach what they need to teach in a way that they can learn what they need to learn. And I think we certainly can as parents too, and we can recognize when we do get to that point where our anger may be taking over and giving us temporary insanity, which is what anger is about. It closes off our thinking, it closes off our logical functioning, that we may just need to take a time out and say, I can't deal with this right now, I am going to spend some time over here, and you know, we both need to think about it. Yes?
In addition to the physical, like pulling, pushing, slapping, I think that the parents' tapes we carry around in our head sometimes come from the words that we heard, mm-hmm. and the shaming and the yelling and similar.
Yeah. And some of those tapes that are in our head are also telling us, getting us back to those times when we were smaller, when someone, it may have been the neighbor kid, it may have been neighbors, it may have been relatives, it may have been teachers, it may have been our parents at a time when they've lost it, when we were labeled as being idiots, dumb, stupid, unkind, you know, all the kinds of labels that can disable. And all of a sudden, something triggers, and I'm back being that little kid being called stupid or dumb, or uncontrollable, or inconsiderate, or whatever it is that was called at that time, and I go back to acting like that again. Or assuming that that's what my child is going to be acting like, and I've got to prevent them. So, a neat book. And I realize that all the most of the parenting books from the library are gone right now. But one that I found very helpful, it's very similar to the book called Talking So Kids Will Listen, Listen So Kids Will Talk, by Faber and Maysish, and Nancy Samelin, who's written Loving Your Child Is Not Enough. She's also, her book that came out just after this is called Love and Anger. That's really quite good, and it was so good somebody decided to walk off of it at one of my anger classes. But I like this title, Loving Your Child Is Not Enough. It's important, but what else do we want to teach along with that loving? Loving is basic. It needs to be there, unconditional love. Not because you do this, do I love you. And not because you brought home an A on the report card or cleaned your room or wrote a proper telephone message. I love you because you are you. And that's basic. And so if we can get some of those positive tapes that start playing in our kids' heads so that they'll grow up and say, well, we deal with the action and not label the child. We can describe what we don't like and deal with the specific instance. I don't like you hitting. I don't like you to tell things that aren't true. When you agree to do such and such, I expect you to be able to follow through on it rather than you're unmanageable and you're unreliable and I can't ever depend on you. You never do anything right. I mean, how many times do we ever get labeled with a never or an always as if we were our actions rather than what was just done is not acceptable, but you still are. Okay, so we want to look at discipline as showing children what they have done wrong, gives them ownership. So that we do not teach kids quite unconsciously to always put a blame. Well, I could have done, but it was your fault. It's not my fault. It would have been okay, but, you know, and always put the blame on somebody else. Give them ownership of the problem. And then it's not a terrible, bad, horrible thing to have a problem or to make a mistake. What would be terrible and horrible and a very bad and no good thing would be not taking responsibility for it and learning from it. To miss that opportunity to learn.
Kathy?
Yes?
decision, letting them be the decision makers.
Yeah. And that's, this next one, give them ways to solve problem or the opportunity to solve it. And that I would follow your comment, Mark, as saying that instead of just having them be part of the problem, they need to be part of the solution.
Yeah, it's their decision.
And that's probably one of the best gifts we can give our child, is to teach them how to be good problem solvers. Taking that responsibility and trying to figure out what can I do so it doesn't happen again. And then to leave dignity intact. So, what are some ways that we can go about helping children learn from what they've done? This is actually a handout that I developed at home back in probably 89. It's not that I have a lot, it's that we use them regularly. If you want to take one for family, I think there should be enough to go around. To look at the choices that we have for dealing with the behavior that we want them to change. And it doesn't matter whether they happen to be preschoolers or whether they happen to be teenagers. Most of these will work for a variety of levels of age. Some may be more specific for one and some for the other. But I think we need to, whether we have these preschoolers, they will grow up, so we want to look ahead to what comes next. What are some of the next ways we can deal with them? Rudolph Dreikers has told us a long time ago that kids, and I would expand that to people of all ages, misbehave, do things that are probably not very helpful for one of four basic reasons. There's a few others, but for one of four basic reasons. They either want to get attention, they want to get power, or if they've had power used on them, they want to get back or revenge. And then we also use inadequacy as an excuse. I can't do that. That's not for girls or that's not for boys. Probably most often it's somewhere between the attention, the power, and the revenge. For teens, it may be excitement, it may be superiority, it may be adventure, peer pressure. Could also be not feeling well, not knowing what the rules are. But basically attention, power, revenge, and inadequacy. Sometimes it's helpful to figure out what's really going on here. Because so often, instead of thinking of those basic categories, we think, they're doing it just to get back at me. They're doing it just to get my goat. And we so easily give away that goat. We let them affect us and change us and influence us, probably in very negative ways. And then we begin to say, you made me. It's your fault. And then we get switched around as if they're the parent of me rather than me being a parent of them. So we need to remember who's the adult in the situation, who's the child, whether they happen to be, you know, 18-year-olds or 8-year-olds. What are some of the reasons for why we do some of the things we do? And we might check back and figure out that sometimes it was to get, because somebody wasn't paying attention, or somebody was using power on me and I wanted to use power back on them, or I felt I needed some power. I'd lost all power. Probably that's one of the reasons why we get so mad and angry and upset with our children. We feel that we are so helpless, that they have taken over and they shouldn't take over. That's my job. And we get all upset and angry and tied up in knots, and we have to do by power, which often defeats us. Instead of saying, hey, we've got a problem here that needs to be solved, and to share the power. Once we can share the power, they are more likely to follow whatever the decision is than if we try to stamp them down with it. Because that will just bring out their revenge or their resistance to us.
Can you give an example of the inadequacy? I understand the other three.
Oh, math's too hard for me. I can't. I mean, I'm a girl. Girls aren't very good at math. I just can't do math. I'm not going to do my homework. Forget about it. I'm not going to do any homework. I can't ever do it anyway. Everybody says I'm bad at math. Why bother? Taking some responsibility for walking the dog. Or, I really can't remember to feed the dog all the time. And sometimes, it's just too much. I can't do anything else. I'm going to have, you know, they can just find all sorts of excuses for why not wanting to do something. For some kids, it may not be so much inadequacy, it's fear of failure, though, too. And they'll say, well, I don't think I can try. And sometimes we find that in families where you would at least expect to find, if you think that everybody's so upbeat and they're positive and everything's going, but then there's someone in the family who says, oh, I can't do that. I'm no good at languages. I want to drop French, or I don't think I can take that. You know, they can get up to be teenagers, they can be doing very well in schoolwork, and then they'll decide to drop something because they aren't doing perfectly at it. And you think, oh, that's the perfectionist in it. That maybe their weird rule, back to that cartoon, a misunderstanding, something that a parent said, and they feel that parents have such high expectations for them that there's no way they can meet them, so why bother trying? Or we may, without realizing it, saying, gee, you really studied so hard for that test and you only got a B? Well, why didn't you get any better? I guess you're going to have to study even harder for it next time. You know, your brother didn't have any problem with that class. I don't see why you should have any problem with it. You're just going to have to, and so there was, you know, I can't ever. You know, it was a real, but you don't understand, it was really that, but you can do it. If your brother could do it, why can't you do it? And then they just sort of give up that nothing they ever do is going to be okay enough. Because of real or imagined expectations. Okay, there's 23 choices here. And we can go over them very quickly. And the first one is probably the most important, at whatever age, and it continues on until you die. When Phyllis Stonebrook was doing the dance here this past weekend, and getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning doing the stretching, I was always amazed at how at 7 o'clock in the morning, those of us who were out there, she was always so positive and encouraging, and, oh, you're really doing so well. And I commented to her about that, and she said, I really had to teach myself that, in working with a lot of students to get them to keep going and to accept the possibility that they can do and to be encouraged by it. If we can take a note from that and, you know, catch them doing something right and not always wrong. One scene that's indelibly impressed in my memory happened a Christmas or so ago in a little shopping mall near where we live. And I don't know where it all began, but I was looking at the store window and all of a sudden my attention was focused on this little 3 or 4 year old little boy plaintively crying, I'm a good boy, Mommy, I'm a good boy, Mommy, 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 I'm a good boy. And he was sitting on the back of a little wagon. The mother was very determinedly pulling that wagon across. And without looking back, saying to this little kid, you're a bad boy, you're a bad boy, you are a bad boy. This went back and forth 3 times. The little kid crying, I'm a good boy, Mommy. The mommy responding several times, you are a bad boy, you are a bad boy. I keep trying to figure out what do I do in a situation like that. Do I go and hand him one of my cards and say, come to one of my parent education classes, or to say, sometimes it's really difficult to deal with kids in a public place when they want to do something you don't want them to do.
I wonder what her reaction would have been if you walked up to her and said, you're a bad parent, you're a bad parent. And then when she went to protest, you could just point silently at the child.
No, you can't. We always think of these possibilities after the event is gone, the opportunity is gone.
You can always pray. Whether you act out loud or not, you can always act through prayer.
And that reminds us that we can always pick up the pieces somewhere or other when we have done something that we decided afterwards, hey, I really blew that. And to go back and apologize and to say, let's erase what just happened. I was really out of control and did not mean what I said. Let's see if we can start over again and figure out what the problem is and what we can do to resolve it. Because I think both you and I know that that behavior was not very helpful. And I also know that how I reacted to it was not very helpful, but how can we put these pieces back together? And that we can learn. What is it we want to teach them, and how can we best go about teaching what we want them to learn? So that description, and I like the handy-dandy all-purpose word of describe. You can describe what you like, describe how you feel, describe what you need, describe your expectations without putting down the other person. Sarcasm, ridicule, and embarrassment have no place in human relationships, is my feeling. I don't think it helps anyone. One of the titles in this book, Loving Your Child Is Not Enough, is labeled Constructive Criticism Isn't. And that's really quite interesting, the subtitles on self-esteem. That by the definitions of those two words, it's not helpful to put them together.
Absolutely.
And there are other ways of dealing with some of those which are in this list here. Okay, so to acknowledge and appreciate positive behavior. If we look at that list of what Dreiker says, the reasons why children misbehave, the attention is one of them. And when we look at this first choice of acknowledging and appreciating positive behavior, if kids want attention, and they know they can get it by doing something that will be recognized, that will give them their goal of attention. It can be a positive goal of attention. I mean, a kid comes home from school and says, oh, let me look at my picture. Then there's nothing wrong with that. It's a kid who goes kicking somebody, pay attention to me. What's one of the cartoons in the paper, I forget who it was, Arlo and Janice is in our paper, and Dad is reading the newspaper, and Brad comes in and tries to get Dad's attention, and he doesn't get Dad's attention, so he has a paper bag, and he goes, blows it up, and then he goes, pop, like you did with popcorn bags, and Dad, of course, jumps, and the little kid says, pay attention to me. When some kids will go to quite a length to get that attention that others may not. So if you find that kids are often doing things so they can get your attention and that it's a negative response, then how can we give them show appreciation and positive attention with positive things so that they know if they want to get our attention, a better way of doing it, a helpful way of doing it. Yeah.
I don't know if anyone else has a problem with this or not, but probably do. What I find is if one wants attention and you start to give it, then the other one immediately wants attention at the same time. And my children are little.
Happens even if they're bigger, it happens even with teenagers. And, how would you describe the situation? Describe it in words.
It can be either negative or positive. It can be, my daughter's always doing artwork. Mommy, look at what I made. And Marcus comes up at the same time. Mommy, my shoe's untied.
Well, you've got something that you want me to see, and you've got a need that you want me to help you with, and how can I do both at the same time? So you might describe what you see the problem to be. I see two people who want my attention right now, and I'm only one person. I wonder how I'm going to do it. Should I, how do you go ahead and solve that problem? Let's figure that out.
And include the children in it.
Yeah. While I look at your paper, can you tie his shoe?
That's offering a solution to them. Yeah. Give them time to offer a solution first.
Sure. How to resolve this? Got any ideas? How can one person be in two places at the same time? Got any ideas? So, see if they can come up with one, depending upon their age, whether they're capable or not of coming up with some ideas. And they may say yes or no. If they're old enough to say, I think we've got to think about that. You want to encourage thinking, but they've got a head up here that can be put into work. So you can sometimes talk about it when you're in a no problem time. if you've got a lot of high emotions, you're probably not going to be able to solve the problem right then and there. You may have to find some time to cool down first because you're not thinking. Your thinking brain is shut off with high emotions. But sometimes when things are all quiet and you're around doing some things, you got to say, you know, there's sometimes that when I come in or whatever the situation may be, you both want my attention at the same time. Now, what can we do ahead of time? How can we figure out some ways ahead of some possibilities ahead of time so that when it does happen, we've got something ready to work on, what the solution might be, so that you can begin to do some of this problem solving ahead of time. And what you are giving them in the process is an extra measure of self-esteem. Mom thinks I'm capable of figuring something out. And she's involving me. I'm not just a problem. I can be part of the solution as well. You're also teaching them how to think. And you're giving them some skills in problem solving. All three of those gifts are worth more than anything you can order out of a catalog or a department store for any amount of money. These are going to be things that will be with them the whole rest of their lives. When the toy might be put aside the day after Christmas, or a couple of years later when they've outgrown it. But the gift of feeling okay about themselves, I'm capable of thinking, I've got some ideas that somebody is interested in, and I can solve a problem. I'm not just a problem.
One thing maybe an observation is that they read our emotions very well, when whether discipline or doing punishment, they know what we are doing to.
They know our emotions. We have to be angry, and they say, "You're angry, mommy and daddy." And you say, "No, I'm not." And then you're giving them a double message that they're saying, "Well, how can I really trust what you really mean?" Yes, I am, and I either need to cool off. Give them, be the role model for how do you manage your anger. How did we ever learn to manage anger? I had to start teaching the course before I really learned how to manage mine. So that can be an extra gift that we give them, how to deal with those feelings, because we will be angry at times. I mean, it's just natural. It's not abnormal to be angry. What's causes problems is the choices we make and how we act on those feelings, and that's what becomes judgeable. Okay, number two, let your child know what you expect. Be clear setting the limits, and I would hope that all of our families, not just most, that all of our families would have one basic rule in the household for adults as well as for kids, and that is the rule that says, in this household, we will not hurt each other by either words or actions. Because words can hurt as much as any punch in the stomach or in the nose or in the shoulders. Sometimes even more. It may be longer lasting. And when kids begin to hit each other, you can say, well, what's our rule about hitting, or what's our limit about hitting in this house? Barbara Colarosa on her tape says that in their household, the rule is if you hit, you sit, or you go up to your room. And if a friend comes over and plays and that friend has hit, they can either sit in the rocking chair or go home. But you need a time to cool off and to think about what you can do so you can go back and things will work better again. Number three, tell child what the child can do instead of telling them what not to do. Tell so-and-so how you feel. Tell what you need. Tell what you don't like. That's that to describe again. We sometimes say, stop, don't touch the television. And all the kid thinks about is the television. And we may have to distract them, give them something else that they can turn somewhere else, if that's what they want to do. And I think even with older kids to say, instead of stop, you can't just watch television all the time, to say, let's take a walk together, let's do a game, let's do something together. I like your ideas on such and such, getting involved in some kind of conversation. To change. Redirect whenever possible. Five, labels disable. How many of you remember labels that either you called other kids or the other kids called you when you were growing up? And are they labels you are happy about people wearing on your chest today? Probably not. Some of them might be very positive ones. 6, offer choices instead of threats. And then often the words if is it offers a real challenge. If you don't do, then. I mean, well, I just see if that's really true. And so they always test out a threat. You have a choice. What might those choices be? One father in a school group that I was doing said, I always give my kids choices. I tell them, either you stop that or I'll give you a spanking. Which do you want? Well, that's not exactly the kind of choice I had in mind. What is it we want to teach and how can we best go about teaching it? And the very last statement in that section is, don't offer a choice that you are not willing to follow through on. If you don't clean your room up, I'm going to pick up all your clothes and throw them in the garbage. I would have an awfully difficult time carrying through on that one. And yet I hear lots of parents say to the kids, if you don't pick up all your toys, I'm going to throw them all away in the garbage. Are you really going to do that? And some of them say, yeah, I'm throwing through them. I don't know, maybe they feel better about buying them all over again. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be able to, but I guess if that's your choice. But that's not discipline, that's punishment. That's being mean. But I think there are other ways of doing it. If you choose not to pick them up, I guess I'll pick them up and then I put them away for a day or two or whatever length of time you decide. Yes?
You know, the tricky and tough part about all of this is that it's a little harder. Not much harder, but it's a little harder. Because when you're tired and cranky or a child's got your goat, it's very seductive and very easy just to give in to the anger and to say the pat phrases, to do the pat thing with the hand, to, you know, send it, to be punitive. It's very easy to do that, and it really takes some discipline and a little bit of thought, a little bit of effort to say, okay, I have to choose now to be creative in this situation. I have to go out of my way. I have to leave that pot on the stove. I have to leave this project.
Better to take it off for the moment, you know, or turn the burner down.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to do, and I think that one of the things we have to hear again and again is that it's worth it.
Yeah, and you can do it, and sometimes it may seem like it's going to take a lot more energy to think and to figure out another possibility. But I would venture to say in the long run, you'll save energy because you are not going to get so mad and so outraged and use up all this emotional energy and you just end up screaming and you stop and you do all sorts of things. That uses energy and it takes time. And you're not teaching your child what you want them to learn. So sometimes, one of the other things we tend to do when we're very tired is, oh, go ahead and do it, forget about it. And then you just give up and they go away and do whatever they want to do because, you know, you're not going to stop me. But it's teenager or the preschooler. What can they get away with? And what follows into that is that getting the child's attention. Whether they've got their eyes in a book, and with our daughters it was most often eyes in a book, and sometimes we can put a couple of these together, and if you look at number 9, it says use a note. So sometimes when my daughters would have their nose in a book, I would come with a little piece of paper with my message on it and put it in front of their book. And they'd read it quickly, a very short message. And then I might say, now what is it you need to do? And well, I guess when I can leave a note with them, okay, you've got the note, that's a reminder. So I don't have to keep, did you do it now? Well, it's still here, how come you haven't done it? I mean, and then we're constantly after them and nagging, and they just turn off. They just began to learn very quickly when to become parent there. But the note is a reminder to them. They can't say, you didn't tell me, because the note is there. And if you're not into writing notes, to be able to say to the person, what's your name?
Judy.
Judy, I need to have the dog fed right now. I need to have the dog fed before supper, before you eat supper. I mean, that, I think that's one of the illustrations Barbara uses on her tape. Judy, I need to have the dog fed before you eat supper tonight. Now, what is it you need to do?
Feed the dog.
When?
Tonight.
When tonight?
I don't know.
That's
that's a good thing.
Snacker, snacker!
No words from the sidewalk. Before you eat supper tonight. Now what?
Before I eat supper, what else am I supposed to do?
I think you've got it. You know what you have to do?
Yeah.
Feed
the dog.
Before?
Supper.
Before you have supper. Okay. And Barbara say, okay, she comes to the table, you know, the dog has been fed in here, and Judy comes to the table, and there's no place for it. How come there's no place for it? Oh, the dog. You know, I'm reminded. It's not that I'm being mean to Judy and say she can't have supper. It's that the dog needs to be fed before she gets fed. That's a kind of reminder. It's a logical consequence.
Do you have teenagers at home?
Uh-huh. Can you tell? So I have this approach.
You must have stopped Phyllis, huh?
Yeah, but so often we tell them in paragraphs what we might tell them in a word. Or if they have really become parent deaf and they think anything we say is nagging, even if we say it in the nicest way, then we might for a while break the pattern by writing a little quick note. That may save your energy level as well as be a nondescript, non-nagging note to them. We've got to be careful of the words. If you don't forget again, you better remember to. I mean, you know, that can be, even a note can be nagging to say, dehumidifier needs to be empty before you go to bed tonight. So it's very clear, and the time is clear there too, so you don't just say, empty the dehumidifier, and then 3 days later, how come it's so musty down here? Oh, nobody's emptied that for how long? Yeah. So you want to put it at not only what the request is, but when.
I think notes are nice for apologies as well.
Oh, yes. Notes can, and then you can add a sense of humor to them too. You can sign that, please empty me because I hate to be stopped and just sit around with water gurgling inside of me, the dehumidifier. Or if you don't think that you're particularly a teenager is going to be listening to you, if you give an apology, then it might be a nice thing to tack it on their door or on their mirror and say, I really did not behave the way I would like to have when I yelled at you for such and such, and I want to apologize. And I wonder if I would like us to get together so we can figure out what we can do so it doesn't happen again. I want you to know that I love you, and I did not mean the words I said.
In the meantime, the consequence has to take the weight. It's got to be consistent.
Okay.
Consistent. If their supper is not going to be served until the dog is fed, then without any emotion whatsoever, supper will not be fed.
You've decided not to eat tonight. Are you and the dog are both going on a hunger strike? Okay. Well, time is really gone. But I think that's important. How do you carry through without being punitive than to say, I told you so, you never listened to me? To say, I guess you've decided. Because if you offer a choice, and that's part of logical, and that's part of logical consequences. Natural consequence is something that happens without you doing anything about it. They decide they don't want to eat supper tonight because it's not something they're accustomed to. Well, I guess that's your choice. You may choose to eat the supper. You'll have a very good breakfast tomorrow. You'll be very hungry and ready to eat. It's not that, well, if you don't, you're going to sit here until you finish everything on that plate. That's punishment. We're probably also teaching them some things about food and nutrition that aren't going to be more of a problem than they're going to be a help to them. So, to help kids to take the responsibility and recognize that the choice is theirs, and if they choose not to eat, then I guess they've chosen to be a little bit hungry before the next meal. And that because you choose not to eat supper doesn't mean that you have 3 dishes of ice cream instead. We'd probably give in a bit too much of that around here at least. But what's the consequence of their action? And whether it's logical or whether it's a natural one. A warning signal that's when something has to be done, solving problems together, number 11. To look at those skills in problem solving, 12, to acknowledge the child's feelings, to give, label the emotion, identify what you think they're feeling, and that always allows the other person to check it out. No, that's not what, or yes, that is what I'm feeling. So you don't end up with those weird rules of misunderstanding and wear rubber sole sneakers all the way through. Nothing else? Oh, well, shorts, just if only wear that on your feet. Don't wear any street shoes. Oh, you're still shorts and shirt. Yeah. Oh, you can clear that up. 13 is probably the hardest, and that's stating our own feelings with ownership for those feelings. I'm feeling when I see because, or I need, without saying, you make me, you're, I mean, putting the other person in charge of my feelings. I'm the parent, I choose my feelings. Nobody can make me feel anything I choose not to feel. There's more that you can read in that. State your own feelings without sarcasm, accusing, ridicule, blaming on them. Review the experience and problem together to discover what happened and to process it. After everybody's calmed down, maybe even an hour later, maybe even a day later. Remember what happened the other day? How can we deal with this differently another time so that it isn't going to be a problem? How can we work through this? Say you wish, allow a child in fantasy what they can't be allowed in reality. The 16-year-old who really wants to go off for an overnight with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you really wish that you had the freedom to do this, or that I would give you permission to do this. I feel I'm uncomfortable. Barbara Cohen also talks about alternatives to no, because we say no too often that we need to find some other alternatives. One might be as soon as, recognizing that privileges come with responsibilities. Another might be, give me a minute, so that you can really think through it and know why you're saying a yes or no. Another one might be, yes, in a minute. Yes, I will in a minute. And then follow through if that's something that you can follow through on it. One, she says, works best with teenagers is convincing. And she says, why should I spend my energy thinking of reasons why they shouldn't do it, when they've got all that energy to decide to present their argument for why they should do it? And you can just say, I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced. Like, yeah, I am convinced. If they can give up, bring an argument. So that is worthy of you saying yes to. So that when you do have to say no, it's not the concept. You always say no to everything. So that when you really need to say no, they will accept the no, and they'll hear the no and the reasons for the no. And to give the reason for the no, not just because I said so and I'm your parent. That doesn't wash with kids nowadays. Even preschoolers, and it certainly doesn't wash with teenagers. Barbara Cohen also says, so when I have to say no, and they say why, I can say, and they say, you don't trust me. Yes, I trust you a whole lot. You're trusted from the time you leave in the morning until you come back at night. But when it stays out very much, very late, there's not a lot of things you can do, and I want to prevent you from having problems with sex, drugs, alcohol, and personal safety. And that's the reasons why I will say my no. So that you can give a reason and they know why the no is not allowed. We're really at our time. And since these are handouts that you can carry through, let me ask if there's any last question before we start the time. One little statement that I'd like to read. I don't know who it's quoted by, but I think it says some important things. It says, I have come to a frightening conclusion. I am a decisive element in my family. It is my personal approach that creates the climate. It is my daily mood that makes the weather. I possess tremendous power to make another's life miserable or joyous. I can be a tool of torture or an instrument of inspiration. I can humiliate or humor, hurt or heal. In all situations, it is my response that decides whether a crisis will be escalated or de-escalated, and somebody humanized or dehumanized. The tremendous role of a parent, and it's in your hands. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.